Steph Midlock.
And I'm Jude Vase.
Welcome to Atherbeth, a podcast exploring the gripping gaming of Tolkien's Legendarium.
Do we have any... Do we have anything in the corrections calls to Zach this month?
Nothing that I have heard of directly.
Which is shocking to me, because we went on a real dunk fest last month, and nobody got up in our grill about it. I have to say, listeners, I'm a little disappointed. I really wanted the Fëanor stands to come out of the Twitter woodwork and take it to me. You still have time, obviously, but I have to say, I was really hoping someone would come at me with their hot take on why Fëanor was actually just fine, but... Nope.
There's no expiration date on telling Jude he's wrong. So let's just put that out there. You can do that at any time in the future. If you're listening in the year 2146, welcome you to get in touch with us. We'll be dead. But just in case,
dig up my corpse,
you can tell our ghosts.
Revivify it and tell me I'm wrong about Fëanor, and then you can put me back in the ground.
Perfect. That'll be great. Yeah. So, I think it's also bold that you assume anyone listens to the show. So that could also be
also could be the problem.
Whatever. Or we just did a great job telling everybody why that guy's a jerk and they all just agreed with us.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, whatever.
So I want to mention at the top of the episode that there's been a lot going on in the Tolkien community in the last month. It was kicked off by a Tumblr post that described a lot of an incident in which a woman who goes by Eliana on Twitter experienced some microaggressions and some kind of less than micro aggressions and racism at a Tolkien conference. And it really kind of kicked off a real sort of come to Eru moment, so to speak, within the Tolkien community about racism and diversity and how we confront that stuff. And I think it's been super healthy for the community to confront that and to think about how we can deal with that. I'm going to put a link to the Tumblr post in the show notes. But I want to say right here up at the top that we are really interested in how we as a show and we as a community can be better about that and more supportive of a more diverse and more, just a generally more diverse and more supportive Tolkien community. This is something that I've wanted to cover for a while, but haven't felt really comfortable speaking on as a white cis male Tolkien fan. I'm like the last person that kind of can talk about this stuff without having my head all the way up my ass. But I do want to find a way to talk about this subject without also leaning on other people to do the work for me. So that's like a weird sort of balance I have to strike there, that we have to strike there. I don't want to speak for Steph, but that's sort of my feelings on it. So I do want to just say that it's something I do want to cover on the podcast eventually. So we're trying to figure out what's the right way to do that, whether that's via guests or working with some people to help us do some research or something like that. I don't know, but we're working on it. We do want to cover it. But right now, it's important that we direct you to the conversations that are being had so that you, our fans, if you're not already, and I imagine most of you are, can go and see the conversations that are going on and can get involved.
Yeah, that's really well said, Jude. Absolutely. And I mirror all of your statements as well. I was really like moved by Eliana and her Twitter thread and all of the conversation that kind of came from that. And I really want to be a part of that in a positive way and try to be an active ally, right, as much as we can with this kind of small platform we have. So yes, that's something we're going to continue to kind of look at and try to be mindful of as we try to educate ourselves, I think, right, moving forward. So yeah. Thank you, Jude. That was awesome. Thanks for saying that.
Yeah.
So, and we were still in the coronavirus situation. So we hope that you're all staying safe. Things are getting worse in the U.S. right now. And so please, like, stay home. Please wear a mask. Please wash your hands. All the things. Come on, guys. Come on.
Yeah. Don't be an idiot. Don't be an idiot. Just put on the mask, stay home, and...
read some Tolkien. It's fun.
Yep.
Yeah.
As a consequence of people being stupid about coronavirus... this month, we are not at Gen Con. Usually, this month, in years past, we have had sort of dumb episodes, or we've spaced out episodes, or we've had to record something in advance, because usually Steph and I are in Indianapolis for Gen Con, which is a big gaming convention where we play tabletop role-playing games and board games, and more importantly, we see our friends and we hang out, and it's a grand old time. Obviously, we're not doing that right now because of coronavirus. Gen Con was canceled because obviously you can't stick 50,000, 60,000 nerds in one convention center with, you know, recycled air and expect, you know, anything less than a total, you know, disease meltdown. So in the spirit of Gen Con, what we have decided to do is do an episode about games and Tolkien, specifically the licensed games of Tolkien, Tolkien's role in Dungeons and Dragons, role-playing games, CCGs, video games, all that kind of stuff. Kind of look at Tolkien's role in the evolution of these games and then also the licensed Tolkien games. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at how Tolkien influenced D&D, and then flip the script and look at how these games interpret Tolkien and how they, unlike other role-playing in video games, how close they try and stay to Tolkien, or how much they try and interpret his material in their format, and so on and so forth. So I think it's a fun episode, and I'm looking forward to doing it.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for suggesting this, Jude. You know, I I don't really play a ton of video games. I do a little bit, and I really enjoy tabletop role-playing games, but I've never ever played a Tolkien game, nor have I ever even thought about playing one. So this was pretty fun to like get into this a little bit and kind of see what was out there. And there's some really bonkers things out there, so it's going to be fun to kind of chat about that and see where they went wrong or where they went so right.
Yeah, absolutely. If you like this stuff, if you like Tolkien video games or tabletop role-playing games, hit us up on Twitter. Let us know what your favorites are. Maybe Steph and I will do, a Twitch stream of one of us playing a Tolkien video game, or we'll do a one-shot of a Tolkien role-playing game or something at some point. So.
Yeah, it'd be fun if any listeners of the show wanted to play. That might be kind of cool. Put together little fellowship or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Well, we've got many geeky paths to tread. So let's begin. Hard to understate Tolkien's influence on the fantasy genre, obviously, and that includes tabletop gaming. But D&D is a weird case. I always thought that Tolkien had a huge influence on D&D, but we're not going to start there just yet. Where I'm actually going to start is a little before that, and that's with licensing, because.
No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
and you'll see why.
Okay. I'm with you. So, I'm going to stick with you.
Tolkien sold the license. Tolkien licensed some stuff in 1969. And he did it for £250,000, which or $250,000, the equivalent of $250,000 US, which would be about $1.5 million today. And the sort of joke that everybody always hears is it was to pay a tax bill, but it turns out that it's actually a lot more complicated than I always thought, than I always heard. Right. So Tolkien was very wary of adaptations of his works, but he wasn't opposed to it, which I always thought that he was. And I think we get that opinion from his son, Christopher, who was. He discussed it with his publisher, Stanley Unwin, and he said in letter 202, "Art or cash, either very profitable terms indeed, or absolute author's veto on objectionable features or alterations." At one point, Disney considered buying the rights to The Hobbit in 1938, but they decided it was unsuitable for a Disney film on the grounds that it was too complicated to adapt and too mature. In any case, he probably would not have sold it to them since he wrote in 1937 in a letter that he, about Disney, "For all whose works I have a heartfelt loathing." I'm really curious. There's no explanation there, but I'm really curious what it was about Disney that inspired such strong feelings for him.
He just could not fucking stand those little chirpy woodland creatures, I guess.
Yeah, I don't actually know off the top of my head what Disney had come out by 1937 to make him hate it so much.
But it's got to be Snow White, right? Wasn't that a 30s thing?
Yeah, probably.
I don't know. I mean, that is a pretty weird... well, whatever. I don't want to... Yeah. Well, never mind.
Fast forward about 30 years, and in 1969, United Artists finally convinces Tolkien to part with the rights for the aforementioned $250,000 and 7.5% of all gross receipts, which translated to about $1.5 million after inflation. In return, they got the film and merchandising rights in perpetuity, as well as the rights to sell that to another studio.
Oh, in perpetuity, that's forever and ever.
Uh-huh.
Uh-oh.
Now, the old story about him selling it to pay a tax bill is not really accurate. What actually it turns out it was, Tolkien was getting older, and the tax code had changed, which meant that he was getting less profits from the book sales. And okay, he wanted to set up a trust for his children, and he wanted to take care of Edith, who was ill. This is... the articles I read suggested that this is why he agreed to such very generous terms in the sale.
Okay.
8 years later, after attempting to get some things started and not being able to do it, the rights were sold to Saul Zantz, who formed Middle-earth Enterprises. Well, he formed another company, which then renamed itself to Middle-earth Enterprises, who've held the rights ever since. And it's that group that eventually went on to work with New Line Cinema and make the Tolkien movies, and is even today working with the Tolkien estate and with Amazon on the new Tolkien show.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is, in the words of OMC, "You want to know the rest? Hey, buy the rights."
How
bizarre. Okay, I'm done.
Pretty much.
Fine. Thank you for... Great.
So why is this relevant to D&D is the question. I mean, it's interesting, sure, but for our purposes, that's kind of like, what's the point? Here's the point. So in 1954, Lord of the Rings is published. And for a little while, it kind of goes under the radar in the U.S. because it wasn't lawfully published in the U.S. right away. But it's published in like sort of like pirate edition, and then eventually it's legally published. And in the mid to late 60s, it takes off and it gets republished and it becomes an enormous success. So by the time in the 70s, when they begin publishing D&D, it is huge. It's deeply entrenched in the minds of these people that are making this game. So Gary Gygax is apparently kind of a snoot about this. And he's like, well, actually, it wasn't a huge influence. Gary Gygax is the man who one of two guys who are credited with inventing Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
But he always claimed that it was not one of his principal inspirations. He names Jack Vance's Dying Earth and Howard's Conan as more principal inspirations for it. That said, its influence is evident in the first printing of D&D, where all of the principal races are Lord of the Rings races. Men, elves, hobbits, dwarves, orcs, goblins, they're all in there.
Oh, wow.
As well as things like Nazgul and Balrogs.
Oh, really?
And the ranger class is transparently the ranger, like Aragorn the ranger.
Okay.
Transparently. Additionally, in 77, TSR, who owned D&D, released a box set called The Battle of Five Armies, explicitly based on The Hobbit.
Okay.
Intending to capitalize on the release of the Rankin-Bass movie.
Oh, gosh.
This draws the attention of Middle-earth Enterprises and the Tolkien estate.
Who and they're pissed.
The box is withdrawn, making it a collector's item. But more notably, the second edition of D&D changes all those names.
Okay.
So now the hobbits become halflings.
Mm-hmm.
Nazgul become wraiths. Ents becomes trants. And all of the explicit Tolkien names are changed, but the influence is still there. And over the years, that sort of influence has become less and more overt depending on who's writing. But I think my point with this section is to demonstrate that Tolkien's influence in D&D is foundational to the game. I think that's a pretty uncontroversial take. Even if Gygax didn't want to admit it, like, Tolkien as a founding father of fantasy established so many of the tropes that were ripped off in D&D, in all of fantasy. So,
oh, absolutely.
When we talk about tabletop gaming, so much of which is fantasy gaming and so much of which has D&D as its grandfather, that means that it's got Tolkien in its DNA.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is very cool. And so one thing that really interested me when we sat down to do this was looking at how many of these games, when we look at Tolkien tabletop games and Tolkien video games, how many of these games are, when Tolkien comes back into the property, how much are they acting like the game and how much are they acting like a Tolkien property? Like, what's the... Where do, you know, are they acting like Tolkien? Are they trying to be in Tolkien, in a Tolkien thing that just happens to be a video game or a tabletop game? Or are they acting like D&D with Tolkien dressing on it?
Do you mean like canonically? Like, are they trying to stick close to it, or are they just doing whatever they want?
But like, and we'll talk about it for a lot of these individual things. But I think, like, for example, if you go out and you get a generic fantasy role-playing box set,
mm-hmm.
it'll be D&D with the numbers filed off. If you go out and get a Tolkien D&D box set, what are you getting? Are you getting D&D with hobbits and not halflings? Or are you getting something different because mm-hmm. it's Tolkien? And that's what interested me, was like, for these things, because you're going back to the original source and because Tolkien's world is so unique and so rich, what are you getting when you dive into these things? So that's what we're going to take a look at.
I think that, and if you don't mind me kind of, I don't know, giving my hot take, when we were researching a lot of these, many of these video games and tabletop RPGs are set in the same time period, right? Between the end of The Hobbit and mm-hmm. the start of The Lord of the Rings, because there's sort of a dearth of stuff happening during that in Tolkien's actual canon, right? There's sort of there's things happening, but there's also like this time period where it's like, ooh, I don't know. So that's a great time to set stuff. The trouble with it is, for all of these things, as we know, you know, you can't really go too far because we know what's going to happen next. And so you can't mm-hmm. So I think that's the trouble that Lord of the Rings games have, right? Is that eventually, if you want to, you know, if the whoever the creator is, whether it's the GM or the people creating the video game, if they want to go back into it, they sort of have to end in a certain spot.
Yeah, and that's the interesting tension for me in these games. Part of that is the license. The license these games have to follow is the license that Tolkien sold, which limits them to the events of The Hobbit and the events of The Lord of the Ring. They can't go into the Silmarillion. They can't touch any of that stuff. And the appendices have always been kind of a gray area because, yes, they can use the appendices, but they can't. There's so little there and it's so vague. And if they go back and try and do the appendices, that also they, are they touching the Silmarillion stuff? That's why The Amazon TV show was such a mind fuck, because they had to cut a separate deal with the Tolkien estate to be able to cover that material. It looks like. So they're very much hemmed in by the license, which says you can do The Hobbit, you can do The Lord of the Rings. So that time period in between the two is really all they've got.
Yeah.
And that's why it's always been interesting to me, the tension between how much of that story do you stay loyal to? Do you work around the story? Do you play in those blank spaces, or do you just say, fuck it, and do your own thing? And as we're going to see, basically, all of them say, we're going to play around that story. We're not going to, we're going to treat the canon as totally holy. They even go so far as to take the tropes, like the journey that Bilbo and Frodo go on, and the idea of like a traveling company of a fellowship. And they make those concepts like a core part of these games.
Yeah.
Which I think is really interesting, that it's not just the world and the events that they consider like fundamentally like what is a Tolkien story and a Tolkien experience. It's the story elements of those two stories become a really fundamental part of what they consider to be participating in a Tolkien story.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that when we talk about one particular tabletop role-playing game. That's a more recent one that does that really beautifully, I think. but before that one came out, there's a lot of other ones too, kind of starting in the 80s and then moving forward.
Okay, so let's get into it. So we're going to start with RPGs. And Steph, very helpfully, went through a list of Middle-earth role-playing games. We're not going to go through the entire list.
They're boring. You don't need a list. You can just go to Wikipedia if you need a list. There's so many. But
there's like five of them on this list.
There's so many.
The one I want to talk about is the first one.
Okay.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just in case, not everybody knows. So, I mean, I think you all know. When we say tabletop role-playing games, what are we talking about? What is it?
We're talking about like Dungeons and Dragons, which is sort of the one everybody knows. People sit around and one person guides the other players through a story. And then you use dice to determine the outcome of certain actions. And everybody plays a certain character.
Yeah. And it's fun. And if you haven't tried one yet, you should.
Highly recommend.
They're fun. Yeah,
there is no better time than right now to be playing role-playing games. It's a real renaissance right now. There are so many beautiful, weird, great games. Nothing like D&D or like D&D at any time in its existence. The whole spectrum of rules light or rules heavy or, I mean, anything you could possibly want in a tabletop role-playing game is out there for you right now. So please, if you're interested, go take a look. Get on a Zoom call with your friends and fucking play some games.
Yeah, it's fun. So, but sorry, and I did interrupt you. Right, there's like five. But which one did you want to talk about? The first one?
Well, so I want to talk about three of these.
Okay,
let's do it. I want to talk about the first one, Middle-earth Role-Playing. And then I want to talk about the One Ring. And then I want to talk about the very last one, which is the Adventures in Middle-earth, which is basically a hack of the D&D 5e rule set for Middle-earth.
Right.
So Middle-earth role-playing is the first role-playing game for Lord of the Rings, released in 1984. And it was, they published it for 15 years. That's a good run. Tons of supplements. It was apparently very complicated. Tons of material. Why I want to mention Middle-earth role-playing and why I think it's interesting is the lore. So Middle-earth role-playing was around fucking forever at a time when there was not a lot else going on for Tolkien stuff for non-academic nerds.
Okay.
So for a lot of people, if you were like, this was a real source of like content. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's and it was like a space to be creative in that world. Like, this is pre-internet times. There's no like fan fiction sites or anything like that. So what a great way to like kind of live in that world a little bit.
Exactly. So as we were talking about before, this whole like color in the blank spaces thing, Middle-earth role-playing is a great example of there's a great example in Middle-earth role-playing of places where they fill in the blanks a little bit. My favorite example of this is the Nazgul.
Ooh.
Many, many of these role-playing games and video games, when they're going around and filling in the blanks of the story, because they don't want to change anything. That's one thing that a lot of these games don't do. They don't want to change major events, but they want to fill in the space with their own detail. And things like the names of the Nazgul or the backstory of the Nazgul is something that like many, many, many different games want to do, because that's like, well, what's the name of the Witch King? That's fucking, that's a cool fucking thing to answer. Give him some backstory.
And we only know the other one is what, Camel? That's the only other one we know.
There's only one that's officially named.
Oh,
so Middle-earth role-playing gave them all names and backstories. And that was around for like 15 years and then got re-upped by the Middle-earth CCG, which used some of the art, used some of the same art and backstories for those Nazgul in the card game.
Oh, among collectible card game CCG. That's what that is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. In the 90s.
Mm.
So for a very long time, like when I was first getting into Lord of the Rings, many people kind of treated that as like, it was frequently you met people who thought that was canon.
Wow. And so is it like, my favorite Nazgul is Frank. I love that guy. But like,
yeah, you'll still every now and then see people on Reddit, like thinking that what's his name? I'm trying to name one off the top of my head.
I really want to know what their names are. Barney.
Let's see.
Stephanie.
No, not Stephanie.
there should be a Nazgul named Stephanie. I'm just going to put that out there. They'd be like, oh my God, hi, I love rings.
I'm trying to remember what their names were in
Sleepy, Dopey.
Okay, in Middle-earth, Er Murazor is the Witch King. And the others were Dwar of Wa, G-Endur Dawndeath.
These are just Gwar Aklo sounds.
Hill, the Blind Sorcerer, Hormrath of Deer, Adunafel, the Quiet, Ren, the Unclean, and Uvatha, the Horseman.
No! I'm sorry. Oh, no. Oh,
interesting.
No. The Adunafel, Quiet.
Adunafel, the Quiet, was a woman.
Oh, my. That's awesome. Adunafel. So, she's like, shh. She's the librarian. Nazgulet. She's like,
And that's in addition to Camul, the black Easterling.
So problematic, but okay.
Well, in this case, black, yes, still problematic.
So using black
to indicate like evil.
Yeah, it's a big problem.
But not the color, just, sure. Yeah, but still vaguely problematic there. But yeah, these like names were like thrown around as if they were canon for years. And I think that's really interesting. And that's why I think Middle-earth role-playing was really interesting to me, was it was around for so long and it was sort of well-respected and it had so many supplements,
Can I just tell you some of the names of the supplements that I like?
Yeah.
Okay, I wrote down three because they're great. I don't know if they're good or not or what they're about, but I like the Sea Lords of Gondor because that's amazing.
I think the Sea Lords of Gondor is about the Sea Lords of Gondor.
Oh my God, really? Oh. also, the Phantom of the North Marshes sounds like a metal song, so I'm into that. Mm-hmm. And then also, Teeth of Mordor. What the hell is that about?
Dude? Well, I actually know what that book's about. That book is about dentistry. Hygiene.
Yes! Oh my God. Whatever her name, the Quiet, is like, okay, now we're all going to floss.
Well, it's about the Mouth of Sauron, who is obviously the resident dentist.
He's like, okay, we're all doing Crest White Strips today. Okay, come on. You don't need enamel. It's fine. Just do it. Oh, man, Teeth of Mordor. I want to play that so badly. Someone please, if you know what it really is, please tell me. But I think you're right. I think it's dental hygiene.
I might have to try and track that down now.
Oh, God, I want to know so much. Hashtag Teeth of Mordor.
Oh, man.
Someone
okay.
write a song. It's the Teeth of Mordor. The clashing. They're gnashing. Okay, I'm done.
Okay. So, in between Middle-earth role-playing and The One Ring, there were two more role-playing games. The Lord of the Ring adventure game and Lord of the Rings role-playing in 91 and 99, respectively. I don't have anything to say about these. I think we can just sort of pass over them.
Yeah, the Lord of the Rings role-playing game, I think, was... that was from 2002. And that's the one that, like, if you look at it, the cover is like Pete Jackson's movie. So I think it's very much like tied with the movies, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
The One Ring, Adventures Over the Edge of the Wild, was by Cubicle 7 and came out in 2011. And I really love this game. Not only is it gorgeous, yes. I had a long conversation with one of the authors at Gen Con.
Oh, shit, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
These guys love Tolkien. And
you can tell.
Yeah, there is so much love invested in this game. What is really exciting to me is this game really wants you to feel like you are in Middle-earth and you are a part of a Tolkien story.
Yeah.
It has two mechanics that I think are really cool, which is a fellowship mechanic and a journey mechanic, where the primary, like, the primary thing you do in the game is go on a journey to go do something.
Well, so, I mean, that's like all games.
Well,
come on, that's every game.
But no.
Well,
so in a lot of games, you go do something, and then you do something when you get there.
Sure.
This game, like, formalizes the idea that, like, a journey is part of it.
True.
A journey is an important part of the story and gives you tools to, like, make the journey narratively meaningful and helps you and makes that journey aspect important.
Yeah, it seemed like your party takes on roles during that journeying phase, right? Like someone becomes like a scout, someone's like a guide. So it's like you all sort of have jobs on the, besides just being like the fun dwarf, you're also, you know, you've got stuff on the journey to kind of accomplish, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, and there's also narrative stuff that ties into it too for like the story, the GM or whatever you want to call him.
The lore master.
The GM has, the lore master, thank you.
Welcome.
Has stuff that they can do to like make the journey interesting. Like there's an elf king over here who hates dwarves and like, but to like tie it in and there's like audiences. Yeah. And
yes.
Actually, the other mechanic. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, just the, sorry, the encounters are really cool in this game in that you, if you use the ones in the core book, they're all like kind of listed there, right? And like where you would find them. And then you only have a certain amount of chances to like make a good impression with somebody. And it, I don't know. I guess that makes sense for all games, but I don't know. They kind of give you a lot of like I read the one for like Radagast, right? And how he's, you know, and all of the stuff that they had written about Radagast is correct from, you know, from the Legendarium. And it's like, and these are the things you can use, you know, like if you have this information to like make friends with them, it's, I don't know. Yeah. It's kind of cool.
And then there's the fellowship stuff, which is after your journey, everybody goes home. And you run an inn or be a farmer or be a rich ass hobbit who, you know, fucks around with his in-laws or something and doesn't die, like whatever it is that you do. And there's interesting mechanics for how do you make that narratively interesting? What is it that you're doing? Like, recuperating from your journey and from the like psychological strain of that. Really interesting the way that they have gamified, for lack of a better term, the narrative beats in The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings into something narratively interesting that you can use in your own games.
Yeah.
Not just like cookie cutter repeating those things, but finding like the hooks that make them useful and interesting in a story and turning them into like game mechanics that you want to use. That's really hard to do. And I think they really did a really good job of it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the fellowship fee is like one thing you can do is like to tell tales about the adventure that you just had. And so I love that there's like that meta like storytelling level of like your character regaling people in an inn about what you just accomplished. That's so cool.
Yeah.
I think Tolkien would have liked that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was supposed to be a second edition of this one.
Mm-hmm.
But then Cubicle 7 lost the license.
Yeah.
And it was to a company called Sophisticated Games, who then licensed it to another company called Free League Publishing, who then hired the two authors again.
Yeah.
To do another version of it. This is very confusing, but the short version is it looks like there's going to be a second edition of the game, kind of.
Yeah.
With another company.
Yeah, Free League. They're the Swedish company that does like Tales from the Loop and stuff. They're actually pretty cool. So it might be good. It might be good.
Yeah.
I bought the core book and like the dice and I bought some of the supplemental material, which is so awesome. You guys know that I love Rohan and there's a whole book all about Rohan and it's wonderful and beautiful. And like, they really spend so much time. There's like all this, the core book is magical. It has like timelines that are accurate. Everything is so accurate and beautiful. And, I don't know. I feel like it does a great job of walking that line between allowing you some space for creativity, but also like if you want to, it really depends on the lore master, right? Whether you want to embrace all this stuff, but it's there, like a beautiful Cliff Notes version of everything you'd read in kind of the Legendarium. So it's cool. Yeah.
The last one I want to talk about is Adventures in Middle-earth, which is basically a 5e version of The One Ring.
It's by the same company, right? It was by Cubicle 7.
Yeah, it was released by Cubicle 7. Yeah. I think this is a really interesting piece of work. Because it's like taking 5e back to its Tolkien roots, but it's very much not D&D. It's functionally The One Ring, using a D20.
Did like, I read?
That's basically what it is.
Okay. Did I read somewhere that Adventures in Middle Earth is like is sort of the entry level version to the One Ring? Like it's different. It's its own thing. And the One Ring is kind of it's a little complicated. And then this is more of like for a beginner's.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
Okay.
Yeah, because it doesn't use their dice, and it there's fewer like there's less stuff going on. But it retains like the journeying and the fellowship, but it has the fundamental stuff that makes One Ring special, and it's still a Tolkien game.
Yeah,
it doesn't have spells. You can't play a sorcerer. You know,
right.
You can't. You know, you are an adventurer, but you're not like a murder hobo, as the D&D parlance goes, running around just killing random stuff. So it's a really interesting sort of like apex to this progression of like Tolkien and D&D to me, to see how D&D has come so far and then it comes back around to a Tolkien product and it looks as far from mainline D&D as you can get in a lot of ways. So it's very interesting to me. I don't know that I would play it. But I think it's really interesting that they made it.
It made me want to play it. Reading the book like made me,
I would play the One Ring before I would play the 5e version.
Yeah.
But I get why the 5e version was made.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I thought we were talking about the One Ring. So, yes. I have not looked at the 5e version. I don't know. I've just been so anti D&D lately, only just because of all the things, and I'm sick of that system. So anything mm-hmm. that kind of gets away from it is what I want to do right now. But it's great that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, for sure.
Cool. I mean, there's a lot. Yeah. So again, like if anyone wants to know more about tabletop role playing games or anything, there's such a great community out there, and we can kind of hook you up with that. And let's play a game together. Come on, guys, that'd be fun.
Yeah. So next is CCGs,
which are spend
collectible card games,
okay,
like Magic the Gathering.
Ooh,
not going to spend quite as much time on these. there have been three more or less CCGs. The first was in the 90s during the sort of heyday of collectible card games that were set off by Pokemon and Magic the Gathering.
Sure.
From 95 to 99, you had the Middle Earth collectible card game.
Did you have that one?
I did.
Okay, cool.
Not a lot of it, but a little bit.
All right.
I remember the game having really great art. I remember being super the fuck confused by it. But I thought it was cool because you took the role of a wizard or a ringwraith. The later expansions let you play as a ringwraith, which I thought was fucking metal.
Unless it's the quiet one. And then, yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
But what I think is interesting about this is that, like a lot of other Tolkien games, it works in like the journey aspect into the game because it comes with a map of Middle-earth and you move around the map. Like doing the journey and the world of Middle-earth is so fundamental to Tolkien stuff. Do you know what I mean? It is so firmly rooted in the place. There being a map there is the least surprising thing ever. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
The second was the Lord of the Rings trading game, which apparently was a better air quotes game. It was very popular for a while there. It used photo art from the movies.
Can I tell you something embarrassing? I totally bought these. I was way too old to be buying these, and I wasn't buying them for the game. I was buying them for the hot guys on the card. And I
still have
them.
About this surprises me.
Yep, there is no... I'm right on brand here. I still have them. They are in they're arranged by hot guys. So that's mm-hmm. great. Yep.
These were... The mechanics of this game are really interesting. You have two kinds of cards in your deck. You have fellowship cards and shadow cards. And on your turn, you play fellowship stuff to try and traverse to Mount Doom and destroy the ring. But the resources you spend on your fellowship gives shadow resources to your opponent, who can then play shadow cards to try and frustrate you.
Ooh.
Which is a really interesting push and pull.
Yeah.
Really interesting dynamic there. But I mention it mainly because, once again, the fundamental thing you're doing there is a replication of the main story of The Lord of the Rings. And I just think it's really interesting how, once again, you can't escape the main story of these books. And I don't know if that's just because of the restrictive license, or they just, those stories loom so large over Middle-earth that nobody's willing to discard them and do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
The last one is the Lord of the Rings Living Card Game by Fantasy Flight Games, okay, which is the only one currently still around, kind of.
What does that mean?
Well, it's still being produced, but it's been announced that it's going to be shut down eventually. It's different from a collectible card game in that there's no randomness to it. You buy a pack, you know exactly what's in it. The other cool thing about this LCG is that it's one player.
Oh.
It can be one player. You can play you can play against
the deck.
So
solitaire.
You play against an enemy deck, and then you play. It's a cooperative game, not a versus game.
You're so, cooperating with yourself. Wait a minute. This sounds crazy.
The way this game works is you have a scenario and you play against the scenario.
Oh,
What's really interesting is they started out with The Hobbit.
Mm.
So you were playing through the events of The Hobbit.
We're familiar
with it.
And
then The Fellowship, and then you play all the way through Lord of the Rings, and now they've expanded where they're following a storyline they're making up down in they went through Mordor, and then now they're in the Eastlands somewhere.
Okay. Hmm.
But you have these scenarios that you do, and you play against the scenario deck, and you can play one player or you can play multiplayer.
Can you cheat if you're just playing by yourself? I would cheat. I win every time. hey! Rude.
They're gorgeous, gorgeous cards. The art on these is like the best art of any of these games. And the game is super, super fun. The deck building is super important, and that's always been a part of these like card games that I really find interesting. So if you're into that kind of stuff, I recommend it. Check it out. Sort of my takeaway from this section is just, it's another example of the way these games are so strongly influenced by the story of the novels, that unlike a lot of other games based on fiction properties, which are sort of inspired by it and take elements from it and then do their own thing or something like that, they tightly replicate the events and themes and tropes of the novels very, very closely, which is always, to my eye, kind of is the hallmark of Tolkien games. Where the authors of these games want you to feel like you're, if they aren't making a game where you are the main characters of the books, they want you to feel like you're doing a very similar kind of thing.
Okay.
You're on a journey. You're a part of a fellowship. You're questing.
Right.
In a way that other properties, I feel like, aren't as invested in you getting that same participation in the tropes of the original story.
I wonder if you have to do that though with Tolkien stuff, because the main Lord of the Rings story is like the ultimate story, right? Like, and if it just kind of makes every other story lame compared to that, right? So they really need to center you as the most important thing. Otherwise, it's sort of like, eh, yeah. If this doesn't work out, ugh, whatever.
I think they, whether or not they have to, certainly the developers of all these games think so. Because all these games do that. They all center the idea of replicating that feel of journey and fellowship and not disrupting the main plot line and playing in the blank spaces around that main storyline. Those are all sort of the hallmarks of these Tolkien games.
Okay. Interesting.
Okay. Video games.
Video games. Oh man, so, there are some really, really good ones out there. And by good, I mean terrible.
So we're going to talk about three video games. We're going to talk about the Lego video game very briefly. Steph is going to regale us with her orc voice talking about the Shadow of Mordor, Shadow of War series.
Yeah.
And I'm going to talk very briefly about Lord of the Rings Online.
Oh, nice. So take it away. Very different kinds of games. Well, I mean, the Lego game, come on. Have you guys ever played a Lego game before? I know they're for kids, but they're darn fun. And I think that the Lord of the Rings one is the funnest one. I'm not going to lie, I enjoyed it a ton. It's very accurate to Peter Jackson's movies, and that's it. It uses a lot of like voiceovers from the movies. And I mean, it's just, it's fun and kids love it. It's easy. It's like very satisfying. And you get to ride horses, so that's the best part. I mean, I don't know. Have you played it before, Jude? Or have you guys done any? I guess your son's too young.
We played the Star Wars one.
Okay,
we haven't played
LOTR is better than Star Wars. You should try it.
I will definitely do so.
That's my spicy take. So it's better. You know what's not better? Is the Shadow of Mordor. No, look, here's the thing. The Shadow of Mordor was a like total sleeper hit when it came out. Like no one had really expected it to do anything, and it was like a smash hit. Have you ever played this game?
No, I heard about the lore stuff. And
cuz it's crazy.
I got a little salty with the lore, the problems of the lore. With Shadows of Mordor, I heard that the Nemesis system was super cool, and I got really excited about it. And yes. Then I saw a thread on Reddit, on one of the Tolkien subreddits, that was like, the people who made this game have never read a Tolkien book.
No, never.
And
well,
I was like, well, okay.
Yeah.
I can't. Nothing against the game, but I'm one of those people that like, can't be chill about these things.
I know. So you gotta not be. You gotta put it on the shelf because this game is bonkers. And look, okay, so I'm really bad at video games. So the only way I do is just like run away from things and do cartwheels over foes because I can't actually do anything. And I'm like a button masher. So I'm like the worst person to play this game. So I played like maybe 25 minutes of it. And then I was like, I can't do it anymore because I think I got like smashed by a troll or something. But basically, you play as a Gondorian ranger. You're stationed at the Black Gate and your family was killed. And you were killed too by the Black Hand of Sauron. But no, you weren't killed because at the last minute, a disembodied elf soul comes to live in your body and you become a wraith. And the elf soul's like, I don't know who I am. We must travel through Mordor to find these stupid things that will remind me of who I am. And then Gollum's in there? I mean, it's bonkers. It turns out the elf in question is none other than Celebrimbor, who we all know.
Wah.
That sounded like an Oprah doing a Celebrimbor. You're Celebrimbor. You're Celebrimbor. And this is basically, it's so stupid. It's so dumb. Oh, Jude, it's so dumb. Now, that being said, so, I mean, that's the thing. They worked with, I'm just kind of like looking at my notes here. The studio worked with Peter Jackson Studio and like Weta and all that. So the look of it and the feel and the music and all that stuff is sort of based off of concept arts of the art of the movies. So it gives you that like manufactured Lord of the Rings feeling that you're familiar with from the movies. Okay. So, I mean, but the thing is, you're right. Anyone who's going to get upset about lore, you're going to absolutely hate this. The one cool thing about it is that nemesis system. It's a very interesting mechanic in which villains, in this case, like the orcs and the Uruks of Mordor, they remember you from previous encounters. So, like, if they've killed you, which they did to me quite a bit, they will, like, when they see you again, they'll comment on how lame you were the first time they killed you. And they all have these jaunty Cockney accents. Oh, like, Jesus. Maybe they're all chimney sweeps from Mary Poppins. Like, oh, remember that last time when I stuck you like a pig? Ha ha. Like, they'll taunt you if you run away, Cripes. Which I also got a lot of. Okay. And what's pretty cool is, like, these nameless goons, if they kill you, they have the potential to become, like, named captains, which is how my husband and I met our new favorite video game character, which is an Uruk named Pigoog. And, like, fucking Pigoog killed me, like, immediately, and then freaking would not go away. And every time you die, they're like, even if they didn't kill you, they somehow become leveled up. It's crazy. Freaking old pal Pigoog. Yeah, they remember you, and it's kind of satisfying for when you eventually get to take them down. So that's kind of neat.
Yeah, I mean, definitely I heard a lot of good things about the nemesis system.
Oh, for sure. I mean, but no, super not, super inaccurate. And that goes for the next one, too, Shadows of War, which is, you know, the follow-up. And that one is even worse. It's like they just went insane, where there's a second ring now, Jude. They made another one. And it's silver with blue text instead of gold with red text. And they're going to use it to defeat Sauron. And all of a sudden, Shelob is there, but she's like a sexy lady. And she looks like
that
a mix.
That was the part.
Oh, my God. She looks like a mix between Liv Tyler and Floor Jansen from the Finnish symphonic metal band Nightwish. So if you don't know that band, look them
up. Fun trivia. That's Steph's favorite band of all time.
Oh, my God. I love them so much. Which is why I had to put it in here. So when I saw Sexy Shelob, I was like, oh, well, if she's going to sing a Nightwish song to me, then let's do it. But she does not. It's crazy. Like, the ring, I mean, there's some, you know how you mentioned the, like, some of the ring race get fun identities, like the quiet one or whatever? Well, they get crazy here, including, like, Helm Hammerhand is one, and Isildur is one. It's nuts. It's so stupid, dude. It's so stupid. But here's what I'm going to say. They're fun, right? I mean, if you can put your hatred of how badly they are. They even say, like, oh, we had a Tolkien scholar on staff. No. Who is that? Because that guy's got to get fired immediately. It was terrible. Anyway, that was a lot of nothing. I don't know. They were pretty fun. They were really beautiful for the time they came out. They still look pretty fun. I mean, they look good. They're cool. I don't know. What else? What else to say about them? They're dumb.
Wow. Yeah. Oi.
That was a lot.
Yep.
Whew.
So the last one we're going to talk about is Lord of the Rings Online, which is kind of the diametric opposite. Lord of the Rings Online was launched in 2007. It got two expansions in 2008 and 2009 and became free to play in 2010. There's a weird thing with video games where there's like two different licenses for video games. There's the EA has a license to do like movie related video games. And then there's a separate license that exists to do book related video games, which is stupid, but true. Lord of the Rings Online is part of the book licenses. So it follows the book stuff and it is not at all like about, doesn't use any of the movie assets or anything like that. It follows the movie events from The Hobbit all the way through the fall of Sauron and afterwards, and is generally considered to be pretty lore accurate up through until the end, and then it kind of starts making stuff up after the fall of Sauron. But it's widely respected by Tolkien fans and Tolkien scholars for its fidelity to the lore, to the point where like the Tolkien professor does weekly streams of him playing it and talking about the lore as he encounters it and stuff like that.
That's cool.
I played it years ago and it was a really fun game to play. You can be an elf or a human or a Dunedain or a hobbit, and you can run around starting all these different places, and there's all these quests. It's an MMO, so you know what you're signing up for, but it's good. It's fun.
Yeah.
I do like that it gets very into the lore. Like, you follow these epic storylines, and it definitely has a lot of narrative event stuff that follows the plot really closely.
Hmm. So, does it look good? Is it pretty?
For an MMO that came out like 13 years ago, it looks all right.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it looks ugly, okay. But it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't like compare to anything that came out in the last, you know, yeah. 5-10 years.
Sure.
So,
I mean, there's a lot of like Tolkien video games. Like, there's tons of, like, Eurogamer has a great YouTube video, yeah, where they kind of go through like the worst ones. Like, they're pretty funny. Yeah. You know, and some of them are like aimed at children too, right? So that's going to be a different story altogether.
Yeah.
There's a lot of variety.
Yeah, there were a whole mess of them around when the movies came out.
Yes.
A whole bunch of EA games and right. stuff like that.
Like Aragorn's Quest and like all, which Ugh. Is quite, yeah. just not, yeah. again, it was for kids.
There was a weird thing where the Fellowship of the Ring was made by one company, and then Two Towers and Return of the King were made by another.
Oh, geez.
And they were not at all related to each other.
Oh, no.
So.
There's some, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Here's the thing. The bottom line is, Tolkien is, in any form, even kind of a crappy form, profitable, right? So a lot of places are going to try and get their hands on it.
Yeah. The bottom line with the video games is, unlike role-playing games and the card games, a much wider variety of fidelity to source material in video games. People much more willing to play merry havoc with the lore and the source material. But they still want to try and use the fundamental events there. I think it's really fascinating that what people find valuable about Lord of the Rings is that story. It's really interesting to me that when people want to make a game you play in Middle Earth, they want you to experience that arc of events, which is really interesting because for me personally, that's not what I would do. So I would go off and do something different out in the margins. The Silmarillion is full of interesting, weird places, but there's so much in Middle Earth that you could do. I would not, reenact the Fellowship.
That's unfortunately, I think, what people, because there are so many folks who just kind of know a little bit about it, that's what mm-hmm. they're looking for, you know?
Yeah,
so,
no. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
I think because that's all that a lot of people have read, I understand why that's what people know.
Yeah.
But it's not what I would do.
Yeah.
There's so much interesting stuff that you can do in Middle Earth.
Oh my gosh. Like, absolutely. I'm trying to think of like, why don't we all don some bat fells and that was in Middle Earth, right?
Yeah.
It's a lot of cool stuff we can do.
So.
Very, very far from Middle Earth, I would say. Probably the farthest place from Middle Earth might be Las Vegas, Nevada, USA.
Mm-hmm.
Which in the States is where you find a lot of slot machines. When Jude yep. originally talked to me about, when we first started Afterbeth a few years ago, I think you mentioned wanting to talk about licensing and how the slot machine thing was such a major, like, kind of fuck up.
Kerfuffle.
Because it really pissed everybody off. So can you talk a little bit about, like, the Lord of the Rings slot machines?
So the short version is Saul Zantz, Middle Earth Enterprises, through a subsidiary, they claim, made Lord of the Rings slot machines. So the Middle Earth Enterprises claimed it had no knowledge of this. They had a subsidiary that was doing licensing for games. And that subsidiary said, sure, slot machines, why the fuck not? And as a result, a bunch of Lord of the Rings slot machines got made. And the Tolkien estate fucking plots. And they sued the almighty Christ out of Middle Earth Enterprises and New Line Entertainment, not just over the slot machines, but they eventually went to the mat over profits from the films. And it was a huge deal. It was kicked off by the slot machines, but it was a huge deal. And they settled out of court, but it's generally believed that the Tolkien estate took New Line Cinema to the fucking washers over this. because New Line, so did Peter Jackson, actually. It's generally believed that New Line was doing some dirty business with their books on the Lord of the Rings to try and keep other people from getting at the profits. They claimed that they lost money on the Lord of the Rings in order to prevent Jackson from getting his cut of the percentages. So through creative accounting, basically. When all of this went down, I mean, like I said, it was a out of court thing, so I have no idea what the ultimate resolution was.
Sure.
But I strongly suspect that the Tolkien estate came out of that quite a bit wealthier. So.
And so did a 73-year-old Michigan man in oh no, I didn't write the year down. Oh shit. Oh well, whatever. But the company that makes those dorky slot machines, WMS, at some point, because Stephanie didn't totally write the fucking year down, but had its largest payout ever when a man was playing, or man, a person, I don't know who they were, was playing the Lord of the Rings progressive penny slot machine at the Palace Casino in Biloxi, Mississippi, and won $7.2 million. So that was pretty cool.
How about that?
How about that? Take that, Sauron. Eat it. Ha ha!
I have very, well, I have memories, I don't know, very distinct, but I have memories of these slot machines in Vegas. Some year, I don't know, when our group of friends did a trip to Vegas a number of years ago.
And why don't you remember them, dude? Is it from
a very long time ago?
Oh, I bet that's why. Oh yeah. Oh brother. Well, I mean, here's the thing though, besides, you know, despite being sued, they're still being made. Like another like machine, like a more updated one came out in 2018 called The Lord of the Rings Rule Them All. So it's still, they're still there. I mean, I think you can, I watched a YouTube video of a guy playing one in 2017 in the Venetian. So I think you can still find him. So, oh my God. So if any, okay, look, we're all on lockdown, but if any of our listeners ever go in the future, you have to take a picture with one of these slot machines if you find one and like, please tag us because I want to see so badly.
Agreed. Yeah.
Silly. There's definitely like in the YouTube video, there's like a Galadriel wannabe voice actress lady being like, spin the one ring, blood of blue. And it's like, what are we doing? It's beautiful. I think after a few Bloody Marys, I would like that. I'd be like, okay, let's do it.
Yeah.
No, I'm not.
I could see that.
Wow. There's a lot. I mean, here's the thing. And there's also like, there's board games. There's Risk. There's a Trivial Pursuit, Lord of the Rings. There's so many other games that we haven't even explored. So like, if we missed out on any games that you really love for Lord of the Rings, you should definitely tweet at us and let us know. Because maybe we'll circle back someday and talk about this again. Because boy, there's a lot here. It's kind of interesting. Yeah,
definitely.
Cool. Well, thanks for introducing that to us, Jude. I think that was really cool. I don't think I'm going to continue playing Shadow of Mordor because I know how it ends and it's stupid. But it was fun to play for 25 minutes and meet Pigoog, my new favorite orc or whatever he is. Pigoog.
Apologize to your husband for me.
There's a lot of me doing Pigoog voices around the house now. He's not a fan. There's a lot of like, all right, what should Pigoog have for dinner tonight? And he's like, fuck's sake, please. He's going to strangle you, dude. Oh, Pigoog. This episode is brought to you by Pigoog, who I made a war chief by being stupid. Oh, brother.
Oh, brother. Well, on that note.
Whoa!
Synchronicity.
Oh, geez. We got to break up, dude. May go ever on and on, but this episode is over.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes as it helps increase our visibility. You can find us on the web at www.podcast.atherbeth.com. You can find the show on Twitter at @atherbeth_cast. Jude can be found at @aramiticjude. Steph can be found at @thenorthfour. Title music is Lord of the Devil Rings by Pony Music, courtesy of Pond 5. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening, P-Goog. That was terrible.